Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, wanted you to know today's episode is about psychedelic drugs and our conversation is for educational purposes.
Hey guys, it's Candace
and Kayla, and we are directionally challenged.
Yeah, we thought we would have it all figured out by the time we were in our 30s.
But surprise, we don't.
No, we don't. But Kayla, I have a question for you.
Ooh, what?
Why did the mushroom go to the party?
I have no idea why.
Because he was a fun guy.
That's actually good. I like that joke.
I've been like so excited to start this conversation off with that joke, like a giant dork. Guys, we're going to get super groovy in this podcast episode today. We're going to talk about psychedelics. I sound so old.
Groovy made you sound a little old, but that I will be the first person to say that's not a word you usually use. You guys, we're going to talk about the three big psychedelic drugs today. Candace and I don't know much about them. And when she first brought this topic up as an idea for a podcast, I thought this was brilliant because we truly are a little lost in this topic. And so we are going to bring on an anthropologist and have a fantastic conversation with her. I know nothing about psychedelic drugs. Candace, did you know anything about this before when we started the research for this episode?
I mean, I've heard of them. You know, the name of magic mushrooms have come up in topics of conversation. No, you can find, we're also talking about ayahuasca. I feel like you can find people talking about psychedelics everywhere right now, whether it's mainstream TV or news articles. I mean, Goop did a whole thing on microdosing. So it's very present in pop culture. Not only is it present in pop culture, but it's really present on our ballots when you're going to vote. Mm-hmm. The movement to decriminalize psilocybin, which is the psychedelic drug produced naturally by magic mushrooms, in the United States began in the late 2010s. Denver, Colorado was actually the first city to decriminalize magic mushrooms in May of 2019. Other cities like Oakland and Santa Cruz in California also followed in Denver's footsteps by decriminalizing magic mushrooms in June of 2019 and in January of 2020. Also, Somerville, Massachusetts just decriminalized magic mushrooms in January of 2021. And you guys might have heard in November of 2020, the big news of voters in Oregon passing the Oregon ballot measure 109, which made Oregon the first state to both decriminalize magic mushrooms and also legalize them for therapeutic use. So they're kind of everywhere right now, which opened up a whole other conversation between you and I, Kayla, about other psychedelics like ayahuasca and peyote. And we figured we would take this opportunity on the podcast to educate ourselves a little more.
Right. And like marijuana before it, psychedelic drugs, once were considered illicit, are now going mainstream. And that's the conversation that we want to have. Will it follow in the footsteps of marijuana? Is it going to take its own course? And what's the future of all of this? So you guys, today we sit down with Dr. Bia Labachi. She's a Brazilian anthropologist. Her main areas of expertise are the study of psychoactive substances, drug policies, shamanism, ritual, and religion. She's the author, co-author, and co-editor of 17 books, one journal special edition, and several peer-reviewed articles.
In 2016, Dr. Bia Labachi also co-founded an online ayahuasca learning hub called Chakruna. It's a venue for publication of high-quality academic short texts on psychedelic plant medicines.
So without further ado, here is our conversation with Dr. Bia Labachi.
And we're here with Dr. Bia Labachi. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a lot of questions for you about psychedelics. We want to kind of talk about the three main ones, which I'm sure you're going to, you could tell us if there are more. But we want to talk today a little bit about what's become known as magic mushrooms or psilocybin. I always pronounce it wrong. Psilocybin mushrooms, ayahuasca, and peyote, and how they've really become quite popular in conversations today. And we are starting to see a lot more of these psychedelic drugs on our ballots when it comes to voting. So first, I want to talk about psilocybin mushrooms. And why do you think right now people are starting to want to see them used in a medicinal way? Why are we seeing them on our ballots today?
I think psilocybin has been used. Mushrooms have a long tradition of use in the underground in the United States. There's a very strong culture around consuming mushrooms in the U.S. So it's been spread in the scene of festivals, but also in like small circles of connoisseurs and enthusiasts and activists and people that are passionate, that have been growing mushrooms. And you know, there is the gourmet and culinary side of it. Then there is the exploration side of it. There is a scene related to more therapeutic and existential pursuit. So these things have been widespread and are part of culture and have been integrated into our communities. It's not like they're starting to emerge now. Perhaps they're starting to become more popular and visible now, but they have been around for a long time. I even attended this whole fair, for example, in the San Francisco Science Museum. Here in the Bay Area, there's this whole day of Mushroom Day. And of course, it's not just related to psychedelic mushrooms. There's all kinds of mushrooms. But anyway, it was a fair, and you can see like zines and t-shirts and biohackers, all kinds of communities that are interested in this phenomenon. And with the advance of clinical trials and drug reform policy, these movements that were more underground and unknown and discreet and more related to just a few people that know each other start to come more visible. But I wouldn't say there are more, you know, people are doing this more now. We're just listening more openly about this now.
Now, you talk about the therapeutic side of it and drug reform, and I think that's possibly why we're seeing it on our ballots more often than we have previously. Obviously, Oregon is the first state to legalize magic mushrooms for therapeutic reasons. Is this something we're going to see more regularly? And will this be equivalent to what we've seen with marijuana and how it's used in therapeutic ways?
Well, it's always a big, you know, it's hard to do this futuristic exercise because we don't know what's going to happen and things are moving very fast. So I'd say that in the last 2 years is an entirely different scenario than what we've seen before. So it's a bit hard to predict what's going to happen. I can say that I have been studying and observing and doing field work around psychedelics for 24 years. And it's been really overwhelming, the explosion of things on all fields, on all parts of the psychedelic movement. So there's a million new psychedelic businesses are emerging, psychedelic apps, and all kinds of professions that are getting interested in psychedelics, psychedelic as a legal career, as chaplaincies, nurses, and, you know, designers, creators of new technological and virtual reality and intersection with psychedelics. So a lot is happening on different levels of culture. I am chief editor of the MAPS Bulletin, and we're going to host our next edition is going to talk about the new psychedelic ecosystem. And we're trying to do a map on what's happening on different areas. So the emergence of multiple cultural magazines and journals that report on psychedelics, but also different grassroots organizations, nonprofit organizations that emerge, different careers, different projects, different initiatives. There's a lot going on. I think that mushrooms have for sure helped a lot of people, and there is a huge movement of people that have used mushrooms for healing and therapeutic purposes, and these communities are coming together. There's also a strong underground community of growers, like there is with cannabis, a lot of people that exchange tips on how to grow better and how to make the best out of it and combine with other potential substances. And so, yes, I think these things are becoming more and more organized, and there is less and less stigma, and there is more and more progressive reform. And of course, there's also more big money and big pharma eyes on all of this.
I feel like the only thing I really know about where magic mushrooms or mushrooms with the psilocybin within them would grow is on top of cow poop. Why is that something that has been told to me? Is that true? Is that where they come from? Where do magic mushrooms grow?
Yeah, they grow out in nature, and you can search for them after the rain. Although, you know, I am a researcher and I'm not really sure if it's my role to give that kind of tip. But let's just say that they are part of the lovely garden of Mother Nature to the humans. And they have been used through different times and spaces and cultures. They have been brought to our attention by Gordon Wasson in the mid-50s when he visited the town of Huautla de Jimenez, where he met the famous Mazatec healer, Maria Sabina, who was just one healer among many others. And the Mazatecs are also not the only traditional people that use mushrooms in the sierras of Mexico, in the mountains of near Oaxaca. And that's how kind of we got to know more about mushrooms. But they've also grown in other continents and have other modalities of use. In our conference that we're hosting, the Chicrena Institute for Psychedelic Plant Medicines, we're going to host a panel about fly agaric mushrooms. And it's talking about all of this phenomena. And, you know, there's a whole movement in Siberia and also in Europe, other traditions of use of mushrooms. So it's a vast territory, and there's many different branches and ways of using it. And what I am particularly amazed is how this is also part of the US culture, because there is a tendency to say, oh, these things are, you know, a magic ancient tradition from the Americas or from Siberia. But there is also a strong, perhaps you couldn't say traditional, but there is a strong community and history of use within the US itself. And I think that it is this culture that is kind of emerging now and helping move and advance this movement of drug reform that is really urgent and due.
what for when you mentioned the therapeutic and spiritual use historically for mushrooms, what were these practices like? What was the goal from consuming these mushrooms historically?
Yeah, it's a little bit like hard to just summarize the goals because it's part of traditional roots. So I am an anthropologist and I have studied and looked at the traditional roots of plant medicine and shamanism for indigenous people. It's very related to the whole dimensions of society. So we can't separate the spheres so easily like we do and say, here is the religion, here is the therapy, here is the art, and here is the medicinal, and here is the culinary. These traditions have generally, Amerindian populations have, shamanism is really central to their system, their worldview, their cosmology, and it's a means of transmission of culture, of teaching younger generations, and of passing on songs and knowledge about how society works, of establishing kinship relationships. A lot of these societies don't have a state like we do and don't organize things around, having a centralized state and different individuals, but rather have kinship relationships that organize and are central to the society. So what has become famous is the veladas. And the veladas are the rituals that the Mazatec carried that have had a lot of Christian influence and still remain and exist in the Sierra. I had the privilege to partake a few times. I lived and worked 8 years in Mexico and have visited Huautla. And so, I can't say exactly, it's very related to healing, but it's also related to divination and to strengthening ties between kinship and community and so forth.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about how psilocybin is used. They're saying that it can help PTSD and all of these different, and depression and all of that. And can you explain to us just at the basic scientific level of how that helps?
Yeah, I'm not such an expert on the science of it. Perhaps you can talk about, with scientists that will give you more concrete explanations. What I know is that there has been a huge research on treating depression with psilocybin. So there is this big trend of big companies that are doing clinical trials to examine psilocybin's potential for treating depression. And also, there has been one research, this I know a little bit better, because when the PI, he is part of our team, Dr. Brian Anderson, he's part of Chikruna's board, has looked the effects of psilocybin on group therapy to treat older gay men's demoralization. So here in the Bay Area, there's a big legacy of the whole HIV/AIDS epidemic and a few survivors of that time and a lot of gay men, older gay men that have been deeply traumatized by losing a lot of family members and a lot of friends. And they recently conducted an experiment, which was giving psilocybin to people in group therapy. I mean, not in group therapy alone, but then after having group sessions to integrate and discuss, and they have found a lot of potential healing effects of this. And this research has been just recently published. And there's a lot of scientific research also trying to look into the properties of other molecules associated to the main one, to psilocybin, and a lot of different potentials for healing. This is also interesting because from a more traditional perspective, these things are not just, one substance that has one property that heals one disease. But as I was saying, healing is a more holistic endeavor that talks about the dimension of healing oneself, but also relationships between us and other people. So the health community, the community of the collective, and also relationship to the invisible world, to the world of ancestors, to the world between, beyond us, to the world of the dead, to the world that we don't normally see. So healing is associated traditionally with this imbalance on different categories and levels of one's own health, but relationship to the community and also to the cosmos or to the invisible dimensions of reality. And for us, when we translate this into clinical trials, it's more like isolating one substance to treat one disease. But it's a bit funny because they are good for many things, the substances. Mm-hmm. They're not just for one thing. So that's kind of part of the paradox or the challenge of studying in a lab the substances that are used traditionally. Or at least that's how I see it as an anthropologist.
Yeah, you're not going to find that on a prescription bottle. Like, we'll help you communicate with your loved ones while being in touch with yourself and your ancestors. Mm-hmm. But that's a beautiful, really description of what this plant can do. As far as the word microdosing, that has been a big buzzword, I feel like, for the past 5, if not more, years. We see it a lot. We hear it a lot. And what microdosing is, it involves regularly consuming small, sub-perceptible amounts of psychedelic substances. Mushrooms are really popular within the microdosing world. What is your perspective on microdosing and now that it's become more mainstream?
Yeah, that's a bit delicate because I don't want to be like somebody that is, you know, negative or anything, but I'm not such a fan and it's really not my thing, let's say. So I am an anthropologist that have been studying traditional uses and shamanism, ritual religion, indigenous people, ceremony. And, you know, this kind of development, contemporary, is not something that has much caught my attention. And I am concerned with the ways in which the substances can be instrumentalized and vulgarized and banalized by us in our eternal consumerist hunger for novelty and for quick fixes and quick solutions. And especially this whole trend to like become a better business person or more active in your job or, you know, perform higher and the latest Silicon Valley fashion or trend. And so it has been appropriated by this kind of fest culture. There's a lot of also masculinity kind of bro energy and like, you know, all of this that is really not my thing. However, I don't want to discard that. I do think that microdosing has helped people, and there's a lot of anecdotal reports of people microdosing and finding some kind of support, existential support and healing and satisfaction. I think we need to do more scientific research about it. We have published an article in Chikruna that suggests that constant microdosing could have a negative effect on your heart. There aren't many voices saying this, and there's not a lot of real research yet to know what's been the case with microdose. So I think we have to keep an open mind, and we have to keep curious, and we also have to keep honest and accountable. And we have to look at our communities and really try to see if we're trying to find quick fixes and empty solutions or reproduce our traditional extractivist, aggressive, individualistic, capitalistic, consumeristic techniques, or whether we're trying really to find alternative meaning forms of healing and keep a curious and sincere, accountable look at all of this.
You study shamanism, and I'm wondering how, if you can let us know what the shamans and those people who use it, have used it for its original purpose, feel about the modern day person microdosing, and what is their take on it?
I don't know if we can say what the Mazatec think about microdosing. We're trying to promote this conference, Sacred Plants in the Americas, where we're trying to host a conversation about Mazatec perspectives on the globalization of the use of mushrooms. I don't know exactly what would be the particular view on microdosing itself. Okay. There's been a lot of discussion that the consequences of all of the attention that Gordon Wasson brought to Tuapla and then brought these practices back to the U.S. and how it spread and created a lot of tourism in Tuapla and a lot of inequalities and backlashes. And there's been a lot of discussion on how the mushrooms are even disappearing and hard to find these days, and how Maria Sabina grew, you know, old and poor and in many ways not regarded, as despite the fact of becoming this global icon of wisdom and peace and love and knowledge, she herself was not really uplifted, let's say. So there's many different angles, and you know, there's also not just one Mazatec view, there's different Mazatec views. Right. I don't know. I think that we still need to promote more the inclusion of these voices into our conferences and our publications and our, you know, circles and discussions. I don't think a lot of effort has been done in this regard. And at the Chikrina Institute for Psychedelic Plant Medicines, we're trying to exactly do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
It's time to get more in 2024. I know for me, one of my goals is to feel really strong this year. And honestly, so far, so good. Because that's where 310 Nutrition comes in. It's helping me and our listeners in the new year with protein and super rich food products with so many options and flavors. Right now I have the Chocolate Bliss and Caramel Sundae, and they are both so delicious. I have to hide them from my husband so that he doesn't steal them too. They're a triplex protein blend, plant-based proteins that include pea, brown rice, and pumpkin that leave me feeling full. 310 Nutrition also has a hydrate electrolyte drink mix. My favorite is the peach mango flavor. So not only am I hydrating and drinking water, I have an electrolyte blend, vitamin blend, and it's sugar-free. With one stick of hydrate mix into 16 ounces of water, and it can provide the same amount of hydration equal to drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. Thank you. This way I can keep my resolution, keep feeling strong, have greater focus, feel refreshed, and maintain my hydration without having to drink as much. One of my favorite refreshing water enhancers they have is the lemonade flavor. It gives me energy. This one's also sugar-free. It's used with real lemons and it's pH balanced. And this also offers the same hydration as 2 to 3 bottles of water. Right now, 310 is celebrating a new year of goals with code CHALLENGED and giving our listeners 50% off up to $100 for your first order. With so many sample packs, new products, it's really fun and easy to put together an order or start a subscription on products that you know you'll use and will help you keep your resolution. So go to 310nutrition.com and use the code CHALLENGED right now for 50% up to $100 for your first order. That's 310-nutrition.com and use code CHALLENGED. It's all the good stuff your body needs in flavors you crave. So be healthier effortlessly.
We're back.
This leads right into the next part of our conversation, specifically on ayahuasca, which you've studied a lot in your career. Ayahuasca has also become very commercially popular. We all referenced Chelsea Handler went to Peru and took ayahuasca in her docuseries, Chelsea Does. A whole episode was dedicated to it. There was even an episode of a show called Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce, where a few of the characters took ayahuasca at someone's house in Los Angeles. It's become so commercialized. Can we first start what the roots of ayahuasca and taking ayahuasca are for our listeners who've never heard of it before?
Yeah, ayahuasca is made generally of a vine and a leaf of a shrub. So the ayahuasca vine, Banisteriopsis caapi, and the shrub is chacruna, the leaf that is used and combined and cooked and boiled for many hours. It's used traditionally by indigenous people of the Americas or Amerindians, especially all the Amazon. So Brazil, Peru, Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia, the countries that have the Amazon. I am Brazilian and I have done a lot of my research and my career around studying ayahuasca. And I've been maybe 40 times to the Amazon. It's really been a passion of mine. And again, ayahuasca is used traditionally in multiple formats. So you have one kind of rituals that is more for healing or for divination or for even creating territory, establishing territory and ethnic identity. And again, it's a wide and spread, multiple different ways to use ayahuasca. It has also been spread with colonization, you know, with the arrival of the Spaniards and the Portuguese. It has spread to non-indigenous people, so to riverine peoples that created different also kinds of rituals, mestizo kind of rituals. This modality that is more popular nowadays is called vegetalismo, which is a kind of pan-indigenous system that combines traditions from different ethnicities together with some Christian iconography and some European esotericism, and has created this healing system that has also spread back to indigenous people and gone back into the forest and also got mixed in with these more traditional modalities. And then another big branch of the ayahuasca movement is the Brazilian ayahuasca churches, which maybe you all have heard about, Santo Daime.
No, please explain.
Yeah, so you have the Santo Daime and the União do Vegetal. They were born in Brazil in like the 30s and the 50s in the Amazon, in little towns of the Amazon. You know, back in the 30s, 50s, is very small and rural, but kind of city already. But city, a lot of influence of rubber tappers, and they created this mixed system that inherits a lot from indigenous people, but also combined with more Christian elements, with Christianity, but also a kind of traditional form of Christianity that is like a lot of parties and celebrations to the saints. And so not like the more orthodox, you know, Catholicism. And also with Afro-Brazilian religions that have a lot of influence because Brazil has a lot of, maybe almost half of the population is Black. And so there's a lot of influence and created these dynamic rituals. I was a member of the Santo Daime for 10 years, and I kind of know all the hymns still. And it's a very beautiful ritual that you you sing and you dance for many hours. You also have concentration rituals. So the Brazilian ayahuasca religions, they expanded and were imported abroad. So like the old world brought Christianity to the Americas, but the Americas exported a kind of weird mix of Christianity with some indigenous religiosity and brew back to the States and to Europe. And in the United States, you have branches of the UDV and the Santo Daime that have legal recognition.
People go to church and celebrate, like, but they also take ayahuasca at the same time. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the mass, let's say the ritual, the service is with ayahuasca.
So okay, got it.
You don't have a Bible, but you have the hymns. Are the songs. The UDV has a different kind of ritual, but it's also very based on songs and on storytelling. They have a level of different hierarchies. They have a lot of influence of like Rosicruz, Masonian kind of sensibility, and have a more kind of private hierarchical structure. They are more discreet and also more, let's say, organized and structure than the Santo Daime is a bit more fluid with different branches and different combinations, but they're both similar in many ways, and they have their centers. I have also taken a lot of ayahuasca in the U.S. with these groups. The center of the UDV is in Santa Fe, and they're also growing the vine in Hawaii. In Hawaii, the ayahuasca vine grows very strongly and dynamically. And they cook ayahuasca. And so you have a generation of ayahuasca American leaders that haven't really, they were not Brazilian. They learned with the Brazilians, but they are already forming their own leadership, both for the UDV and the Santo Daime. And then you have all the shamanic circles and have a million different variations, also combinations with all kinds of things, with all kinds of therapies or yoga or mantra or musicians or, different kinds of urban religiosities and different kind of ayahuasca circles. And I think that LA and New York are for sure, LA, New York, the Bay Area are kind of hubs of this movement. And so there's dozens of circles happening every weekend. I mean, pre-COVID.
Now, you mentioned taking ayahuasca with the UVD or the Santo Daime, right? Which is there a difference between taking it when you are, is worshiping a correct word or something of that sort? And then have you also taken it recreationally? And is there a difference between the two as far as experiences?
Yeah, I don't like to take ayahuasca recreationally, personally. For me, ayahuasca is deeply sacred. It's really my spiritual path. And I have deep respect and reverence for ayahuasca and consider myself, a soldier of the army, of the queen of the forest in defense against ignorance, prejudice, stupidity, and, all the alienated views that exist around these traditions. I've devoted a lot of my life and career to studying and honoring and celebrating the Amazon indigenous people and the roots of ayahuasca. And so it's not for me like a hobby or something that I take, to go to the movies or to party. Although I wouldn't say that I think that people that do that should be criminalized, because I am anti-prohibitionist. So I'm against any kind of criminalization. But yeah, in terms of my personal choices, I prefer to take it as a spiritual thing in a community with a collective and some people that have experience. It's very important to take these things with people that are really initiated, because they are very strong and they can really, really change your mind. And some people say that once you transverse certain, doors in the invisible world, and then there is no coming back, because you just really see reality and learn things in a different way. So it must be done with a lot of care, intention, proper setting.
What is the process of taking ayahuasca like for any listener that knows nothing about it? As far as consuming it, and then the process of how long it usually lasts, and some of the physical and emotional experiences you might have while on ayahuasca.
You can, ayahuasca can maybe take let's say some, the majority of contexts demand some kind of preparation, you know, some kinds of diets, or at least on the same day, some attention to what you consume. And also just, you know, some refraining from sexual intercourse, or just being in environments that are toxic or very aggressive, and ask people to be in a kind of preparation towards receiving the brew that can have a very strong taste. It's very bitter and very unique, and can be really rough, and can also cause, you know, effects that are strong, like nausea, or diarrhea, or vomiting. And you sit in the ceremony, and one dose maybe will take from 4 to 6 hours, and depending the kind of ritual, it will take one dose or more, and go more or less time. And it's usually in the dark, but not all traditions are in the dark. And people, it's kind of a universal thing of ayahuasca music, although the UDV plays recorded music, but the great majority of, they also have songs. The great majority of context is music. It's, the music is very fundamental in the ritual. And people have their own experience and share, you know, go to these remote places of the universe and of themselves, and generally report a lot of teaching and healing and learning, and love, and a lot of good things. One of those things that even when it's bad, it's good. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's a beautiful path, and it's been very grateful to have it in my life, but I also don't think it's for everybody. So there's that.
I do want to make sure that we highlight the fact that for anyone who wanted to try ayahuasca, that you should really do your research of who you're taking the ayahuasca from, that there are maybe, you know, inauthentic shamans or someone who's just solely appropriating the culture. Have you seen this come up a lot more recently in the rise of popularity of ayahuasca?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. You know, the way I like to say it is like, it's any kind of phenomena. You're always going to have a few rotten apples in there, and you're always going to have a few charlatans and opportunistic people together with the whole. So it's important not to let those be the representatives of ayahuasca. And it's important to find them and call them out, but they really don't represent the whole of this movement. Yeah, there's a lot of opportunistic people, people that want to make money easily, or that just, you know, are on the last trend. And yeah, a lot of naivete as well. A lot of, when you drink ayahuasca, you may have gotten that feeling of this kind of illumination or vision or clarity of truth, a kind of messianic, you know, I am the one chosen kind of thing. A lot of us go through that, this period that you are enchanted and fascinated, and you think you found it and you nailed it and that's it, and you're the one. Even to a point that we wanted to make a t-shirt in Chikruna called Ayahuasca Told Me, because I, you know, a lot of people say, Ayahuasca told me this. Well, yeah, I told a lot of people a lot of so we encourage people to do research, as you say.
Yeah.
And also to consider this as a path. So it's not a one thing kind of solution.
Yeah.
Although some people have one experience and that's fine for them, and that's okay too. But it's something that demands, it's like an art. It's like, you know, like cooking or playing an instrument. It takes time to refine, to learn. And the more you do it, the better you get at it. And you create this relationship with ayahuasca, like a friend, like an ally, like a family member.
I notice even just researching ayahuasca vacations, essentially, that there's a plethora of websites you can go to that have these tour packages that will have you on a 2-week schedule with a shaman, and the whole website is filled with Instagram worthy photos and video diaries of their experiences. Do you feel that that is still an appropriate form or marketing of ayahuasca for people to actually enjoy it? I mean, there was a woman who was saying that she was so excited to try ayahuasca because she wanted the answers to her purpose in life and her love life and career questions. Hearing about the roots of ayahuasca in traditional shaman practices, that those don't really add up to be the same thing? Or do you think that that's fine, that that's just her why of why she wanted to try ayahuasca?
I like to give more generic answers. I mean, there's so many angles. And within my own story, like I drank ayahuasca the first time in 1996. Things have changed so much. And I don't even know what I think anymore, because whatever we think, it's happening, you know. As we speak right now, there's dozens of liters of ayahuasca being broiled in the Amazon to be exported all over the US, the Europe, and same in Hawaii. There's a lot of people growing ayahuasca, other parts as well, Puerto Rico, a bit of Florida. And so there's a huge hunger and a huge interest. It's like a sea full of hungry fish. You know, people are there, they want it. And so at the Chacruna Institute, we're trying to do harm reduction. And our position is ayahuasca, you know, the genie is out of the bottle. It expanded. It went beyond the Amazon. It's a fact. It's on every TV show. It's on the mainstream, dumb American Hollywood celebrity. It's everywhere, whether we want it or not, whether we like it or not. So how can we try to make this movement more mindful, less harmful, more reciprocal to indigenous people? And so we have been engaged in initiatives to raise awareness. We have promoted a series of videos on ayahuasca legal harm reduction. How should you keep track of your sacrament, and how do you keep it? How you should, you know, have your records if authorities look for you. How do you form a nonprofit or a 501c3? And we have produced materials on best practices and safety. And we have this document called The Commodification of Ayahuasca. How can we do better? Where we're trying to raise awareness around, where is this ayahuasca that you're consuming coming from? Do these groups have any program of reciprocity towards the local communities? Do they plant ayahuasca or not? Are they paying the shamans fairly? Are the shamans and the locals recognized, named by name, by their territory, their culture, or are they just tokens or peers as, you know, chauffeurs or maids of gringo sites, you know, that are invisibilizing these indigenous voices? So we're trying to create, and also we have a work with underground communities trying to promote best practices. How can we keep each other accountable? What do we do with people that are problematic? How do we hold this in high standards? So I think those are the kinds of public questions and public policies that we need to be thinking. And, you know, what difference it makes if I'm saying this woman is shallow or superficial in her question or her Instagram post? It doesn't really help. Like, we have to think of this on wider, more institutional public health and drug reform policies. That's what we're trying to do in Chacruna. We also published this resource about raising awareness around sexual abuse, because there has been a lot of transgressions. You know, people drink ayahuasca, they become vulnerable, and there's also a lot of predators, and ayahuasca can make people feel more, you know, aphrodisiac or open in ways. There's a lot of romanticization, idealization around the shamans. So we created this document around this. We also hold a lot of circles with women. And I think, you know, it's like everything. You have to create policies to enhance the positive and reduce risks. And because this is in a such gray area, and because of stigma and because of taboo and lack of any institutional support, it's hard to create systems that are really effective. So it's up to us as communities to build those networks and to enhance the local, cultural, informal means of control. that already exist and are in place. And so I think that in the end, considering how strong ayahuasca is and how it can be potentially, you know, have negative effects on certain individuals, especially if they have certain kinds of mental health issues or predispositions, I think the expansion of ayahuasca is incredibly beneficial, considering all of that. Because what is fascinating about ayahuasca is that it expands, but always with some kind of ritual and community. And that's really interesting. How can this migrate from remote areas to the Amazon, to the hipster downtown of LA, and still hold all those patterns and have people singing maybe in English and having maybe medical doctors doing screenings and not shamans, but there are forms of control in place. And that's a really interesting culturally and delicious topic for an anthropologist.
You put that so lovely. Now, before we move on to peyote, because I do want to ask you about that, you had mentioned something about Santa Fe being a hub, and I'm physically in Santa Fe right now. So is there anything that I need to go see or go do or try?
Well, I think Santa Fe is a kind of hub for different kinds of spiritualities, and there's a lot of indigenous presence as well. Right. What I mentioned is that the UDV main church started in Santa Fe. And so they went all the way until the Supreme Court and then had this huge legal battle and then had years and years of fights with the DEA. And also their main church is located in this kind of like wealthy, privileged kind of isolated neighborhood. And they got a lot of opposition of the neighbors. Really insane opposition, to be honest. Things like, oh, you know, if you drink ayahuasca, then you, when you pee, you're going to have DMT affect the subterranean waters, and our kids are going to drink the water and become poisoned. Like, people have treated ayahuasca as some kind of toxic waste, you know, like if you were dealing with some high nuclear, you know, dangerous thing. And so this church... The let's say the capital in a way of ayahuasca in the UDV branch has been in Santa Fe, but there's also all kinds of circles, ayahuasca circles in Santa Fe. A lot of people from Peru, I think probably one of the oldest lineages that migrated from Peru to Santa Fe. But yeah, I can give you the gold, because then it's not fun for you, so I'll leave it like that.
Okay, well, moving on to our last psychedelic drug we wanted to ask you about, peyote. What is the difference between, how is peyote consumed? What are the effects on the body, and how is it ritualistically performed?
Peyote is a cactus that it grows in the desert mainly, and it's endogenous to Mexico and to the south of the U.S., in Texas, there's the famous area of the peyote gardens where peyote grows naturally, endemically. And, you know, Mexico is the country with the strongest flora and fauna of psychedelic substances in the world. And it has over like 600 species of cacti. So the world of cactus in Mexico is something truly wonderful. I have lived in the semi-desert in this town of Aguascalientes for a few years, where I started my passion about this topic by cultivating a cactus garden. It was one of the more enriching experiences I ever had. I'm also grateful because it's not so hard to take care of cactus. They are very resistant. And what's really interesting about peyote is that the mescaline is kind of it's the protective effect, how the cactus defends itself. So there's not a lot of species that use, that bite and eat peyote because it's so bitter, except the humans, they go and they eat it. So peyote is a fragile, vulnerable species that has been classified under different legislations as threatened. And it's listed both in Mexico and in the US in different levels of like vulnerability. And one full peyote may take maybe 10 years or 30 years to grow. And there is a big rush in the peyote use as well, but not as much as ayahuasca. But it's rough to ingest it, and it's different. It's also a Schedule I drug, or, you know, so-called hallucinogen or psychedelic. but it's a different kind of...
What does Schedule 1 mean? Sorry to interrupt. What does that mean?
The schedule of prohibition. So that would be the substances that have allegedly, according to the authorities, no medical use and potential of abuse, which is kind of really dumb because it's not true. And it's also just very circular, like you can't really research those or consume those because they are these dangerous substances. So you have to do this big loop and, state of exception to research it, to then prove it that there is medical use. It's a kind of catch-22 to start off with. But that's changing.
It's also sad, the catch-22 of the fact that, referencing what you were saying, that the cacti of... is it called a peyote? I don't know if it's called a peyote cactus, but the flowers, the plant, is becoming endangered due to farming practices, silver mining. But because I'm assuming as a federal, under the federal one law of this plant being a narcotic, that no one's really doing anything to protect these cacti, correct?
No, there are some initiatives. They are endangered. Yes, it's a problem. Yes, people are upset about it. Yes, but there are, as a matter of fact, we are launching a documentary called The Peyote Files. It's a very modest in-house production, which is the adventure of me going to Alpine, Texas, and interviewing Dr. Martin Terry, who's perhaps the U.S. leading cactologist or conservationist researcher, and he is the head of the Cactus Conservation Institute. And he has been, together with Keeper Trout and his team, studying peyote for maybe 25 years or more and predicting scientific literature. They do longitudinal studies and observe, you know, like if you harvest peyote, a pups come and is born out of it. And how strong is the masculine in there? And how long does it take to grow again? And how many of these die? And doing this kind of thing. So Martin Terry has been involved in promoting conservation and cultivation of peyote for many years. His work has influenced the Native American church. There's also another project called Indigenous Peyote Conservation Initiative that is funded by the River Styx Foundation that has a bunch of Native American churches, an alliance between different churches with the money of philanthropists from the psychedelic field. They bought a big land in South Texas and are trying to create a project of conservation. The Comanche also have a project of peyote greenhouses, and they have also this related to that is the SIA conservation project is another initiative that they breed eagles. So the Comanche have been breeding artificial eagles for the first people that bred these artificial eagles, and they provide the feathers of eagles for all the Native American federally recognized tribes in the U.S. So breed eagles, get eagles in nature, and when they are harmed, and heal them, put them back in nature, breed more eagles, and use these feathers for ritual use is a parallel with peyote. It's like a species that has conservation dimensions and drug policy or other kind of restrictions towards the consumption that can have an exemption for religious and ritual uses. So there are initiatives to protect peyote. There's also south of the border, the Wisharika or Wichol people have also their own conservation projects. But yeah, in general, these are very modest efforts, very unknown, underfunded, and could receive much more support and attention. And also there's, you know, different communities that use peyote on different kinds of rituals and a lot of controversies around all of this.
Well, I think the through line amongst this entire conversation, whether it's mushrooms or ayahuasca or peyote, is that they're all rooted in therapeutic and spiritual experiences. And how do you experience these plants while also being respectful of these cultures and what the medicinal uses of these plants are rooted in? How can you do it in a respectful way that isn't completely appropriating a culture?
Yeah, there's also, this question is complex because I think that the answer from like a Brazilian or more South American perspective or a Mexican one is quite different than the American answer. Because I think here in the US, this whole discussion about identity politics and cultural appropriation is much stronger. And it's also just, different historical context. So, for example, ayahuasca is not criminalized for non-indigenous people in South America, like peyote is in the US. So you have a big ayahuasca culture of dozens and dozens of indigenous groups, but also a lot of mestizo, riverine, Amazonian users, and the ayahuasca churches of Brazil that I said that, you know, traveled abroad. So I think in Brazil and perhaps among followers in the US, this question, whether it's legitimate or not to use ayahuasca in other contexts, is less strong than the question of peyote here. But there has been also indigenous groups that have expressed concerns about cultural appropriation and rejection of the use by non-indigenous people. And in Mexico, the scene of peyote is also very diversified because you have, let's say, the four main groups that use ayahuasca, that use peyote, are the Wixárika or Wichol, the Rarámuri or Tarahumara, Tepehuans, and I forgot the other one now, that use peyote traditionally. But you also have like mestizo uses and kind of hybrid tipis. So the tipis from the Native American church were also exported to Mexico, and people do tipis and sit in ceremony, but using like Nahuatl songs or Mexican traditions, a lot of hybrid modalities. I was doing this research with a friend, and we mapped at least like 30 circles of these different uses, and also the more new age contemporary, like what people call the Camino Rojo in Mexico, is this hybrid Mexican transnational modality that combines different plants and different traditions. So there's a lot of, different perspectives. In the U.S., you have the Native American church, and you have the federally recognized groups. Then you have only state recognized groups. But you also have kind of other peyote circles that are not either of those. And so depending on where you stand on this net, there's a different perspective. In our conferences, we have seen that. We have host conferences that hold this multiplicity of views. So some people will be entirely against non-indigenous people using these substances altogether. And others think that it's, you know, it's not fair that federally recognized tribes can, but state recognized cannot, because the policies to recognize indigenous people are also, which one is federal or not, have been object of criticism. And there's other people that claim that there's uses of, you know, traditional Western non-indigenous uses for at least 500 years. So it's very contentious, and there's not one simple answer. I think, again, the most important thing is that we have conversations where these different perspectives sit on the table and talk to each other. And that's what we have been focused in trying to do in the Chikrinya Institute. And I really would like to suggest everybody to visit our site and take a look in the work we're doing.
Can you give us the site so we can, our listeners can go to it?
Yeah, the site is chikrinya.net. So chikrinya.net. And we also have, I recommend people follow us on our social media and join our newsletter. We also have a membership program that is going super nice. So we are a bunch of Brazilians and Mexicans, but we have also a lot of friends here and have had a lot of support. I feel very lucky and very blessed, and also married to an American woman. My wife and partner in all of this is Clancy Kavner, and we're the leaders of this institute. And we're trying to celebrate queer people, indigenous people, people of color, women, voices from the global south, anthropology, social sciences, humanity, social justice. That's the take of Chikrinya. in promoting inclusion, diversity, equity, reciprocity in psychedelic plant medicines, creating a bridge between the global South, the world of indigenous people, ceremony, tradition, ritual, religion, and the emerging world of psychedelic assisted therapy and psychedelic science, but trying to rewrite the narratives of mainstream psychedelic science to include these other voices. So we are committed to public education. I have had the fortune of never having a job outside psychedelics in my entire life. And so if you're listening and you're curious and you like the topic, I encourage you to go for it. You can have a career path and a groovy lifestyle. It's hard. There's not a lot of funding. And, you know, there's a lot of opportunistic people coming around. But I personally feel deep gratitude for being able to serve the plants, serve this cause, and also especially to be able to live in the United States, even if this is a madhouse. I think there's wonderful things happening here. And I'm so grateful for the social justice movement that really influenced everything we're doing with Chakrina.
So beautifully put. And we'll make sure all of that information is in our show notes. Dr. B. Labache, thank you so much for sitting down with us. We are honored to have this conversation and to keep this movement going.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your good work, too.
So, Candace, when are we going to Oregon? You don't want to come with me? We're gonna buy some magic mushrooms and take all your advice.
I mean, you're the one hanging out in Santa Fe right now. So just, you know, finding that peyote to smoke. No, this was really, I feel like I learned a lot. I found this really fascinating, and especially it makes me want to learn more about the rituals in which the using of these plants are rooted in. Mm-hmm. And specifically for healing purposes and spiritual uses. I found that part of the conversation really, really fascinating.
Right. I think there was a respect level that she had for not only the drug itself and the plant, but also, you're right, the rituals that come along with it. And it seems like we learned a lot about, you know, how to maybe take that respect and use it in today's practices. You know, a lot of people are microdosing and all of that, and that the respect issue might be missing. I'm interested in it. I'm fascinated by it. I also read that in Amsterdam, they have microdose yoga classes, and we didn't get a chance to talk to her about that. I know she's not huge on microdosing, but something like that might be an interesting way to sort of dive in or dip our toes into this. I don't know. I don't know if I'm ever going to try it or not. We'll see. But it's really fascinating and interesting. And I thought she had such a fantastic perspective.
Yeah, I liked that, you know, she was open. She didn't want to say that anyone's exploration within any of the medicinal properties of these plants and drugs were necessarily wrong. But I like that she pointed out that, I mean, it's so in such like typical American way that a lot of the properties and the helpful properties of these drugs are being marketed as like, do better at work, be more productive, right. You know, as opposed to getting in touch with your inner self and connecting to your ancestors and appreciating the earth and, you know, hearing answers from the universe on like what you need to better yourself as a human. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I really liked that perspective because it is, we're so like, how can we use this to just, it's like so rooted in productivity. And, you know, hopefully that's what we're also learning coming off of a year like 2020 is, you know, is finding that balance again on what is helpful and healthy for ourselves, as opposed to just what all the things that need to get done. And like, you know, kind of using our time only for productivity and getting to know ourselves again, which is what a lot of these, I think, plants are rooted in, is like community and also community within the inner self and your own soul.
Absolutely. I love the way you put that. Well, we hope you Thanks. Guys learned. We hope you guys learned and loved this episode and found it fascinating like we did. We have another great episode coming up next week. We'll see you then.
Directionally Challenged is a production of Pineapple Productions.
Producer, Melissa DeMonts.
Edited by Katrina Henning.
Post-production sound by Chris Henry.
Music by Joe King.
And advertising partnership with Acast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.